morning. My name is Michael McCusker. One fine day, just at the moment she commits suicide behind a lacquered screen in the Japanese city of Nagasaki in Giacomo Puccini's opera, Madama Butterfly, the courtesan Chocho-san's faithless lover Pinkerton, an American naval officer whose nation will be at war with Japan less than half a century later and drop an atomic bomb on the very site of her death, rushes into her room too late to save her. That, in its manifest tragedy, is a mirror to the fate of her city of Nagasaki on today's date, August 9th, 1945, which ended World War II, commencing the nuclear age. Humanity has lived 73 years with the enormous power and consequences of nuclear energy. Since the advent of the nuclear age, few have been able to confront the horror that nuclear weapons represent. And because the majority of humanity prefers to ignore or deny the consequences of nuclear holocaust, it has essentially allowed a free hand to those who ensure its probability, permitting governments to keep secret the vital information necessary to preserve humanity, preferring instead to leave the unthinkable to its perpetrators. The human race has brilliantly invented its own probable suicide. For the entirety of its future, its civilizations and quite likely all other life on its home planet are threatened with a holocaust conceived by itself. It is an act of faith that at any instant, even now in the post-Cold War era, deadly missiles have not been launched from somewhere. Everyone born since the summer of 1945 have lived their entire lives under the doomful billowing icon of the mushroom cloud, which supersedes any other as the most relevant of humanity's emblems. The development and use of atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki will be disputed long after World War II diminishes to history, as ancient as Caesar's campaigns in Gaul. The advent of the nuclear age might always be a topic of vicious and vigorous debate. There is no argument, however, that the world's most accomplished experts on the effects and consequences of nuclear weapons for the past seven decades have been the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. As many as 140,000 died on the days of attack or immediately afterward, and the death toll rose by another 30,000 the next 5 years. Hundreds of thousands more were severely wounded and saturated with radioactivity, many to never recover, dying in record numbers in succeeding decades. The human-powered aerial bomber was a development of the early 20th century and resulted in the deaths of millions who otherwise might not have died without its invention, which made the very sky that envelops Earth the most dangerous threat to human existence. The two world wars, in particular, fulfilled a vision by Francesco Lama di Terzi, who wrote in 1670 his vision of fleets of aerial machines that could fly over cities and drop vast numbers of bombshells down upon defenseless citizens below. Coward flight developed in many directions, but it has been as an agent of warfare that has made its first century, plus 15 years, the bloodiest battle machine in history. The bomber especially has accounted for the slaughter of more victims than a thousandfold of previous wars. Europe was bombed to rubble in World War II. Japan set on fire with incendiary bombs and nuked by American B-29s. The earlier terror bombing of Guernica during the Spanish Civil War prompted Picasso's masterpiece, which portrayed the outrage of ordinary citizens against deliberate and indiscriminate death from the sky. The two nuclear bombs that ended World War II were the catalyst that initiated a worldwide nuclear arms race that has not ended. Then, at the origin of the nuclear age could have been a prime opportunity, if there ever has been one, to put an end to warfare in recognition that the end result would inevitably be humanity's extinction. Instead, a rivalry between the two major victors of World War II, the United States and Soviet Russia, provoked a half-century supranational nuclear competition that even now, after a nearly three-decade hiatus, threatens to restart any moment. The scale and breadth of the nuclear arms race and magnitude of the nuclear arsenals that grew out of it is nearly beyond the grasp of the imaginable. The prolonged, intense, perplexing, and often mendacious counterintuitive process of disputated treaties to prevent nuclear war while simultaneously expanding the quantity and lethality from nuclear fission to thermonuclear fusion, in essence, spoiled virtually every opportunity for disarmament until, quite remarkably suddenly, the Soviet Union collapsed. The 50-year arms race escalated relentlessly with the two superpowers amassing nuclear firepower between them in excess of several million times all the bombs, grenades, and bullets used in World War II. And for all of the multitudes of times American and Soviet diplomats met to discuss nuclear disarmament, not a single weapon was eliminated from either arsenal. To pay for this monstrously deadly escalation, most public non-military and social programs were curtailed or scrapped, and hundreds of billions of dollars were pumped into the Pentagon. The highest defense bill in U.S. history up to that time was levied against the national treasury, $1.5 trillion. The nuclear arms race created immense fortunes for munitions oligarchs and made the economies of both superpowers hostage to military spending. The American economy produced an interlocking mafia of thousands of corporations involved in designing, constructing, provisioning, and stockpiling nuclear warheads, as well as developing systems for transporting, arming, and launching the weapons. More millions of dollars should be factored in the form of nuclear weapons research grants to hundreds of American universities and colleges. The rubric of national defense not only built the private fortunes of munitions makers in the USA and placed them outside public scrutiny and accountability, it also gave them tremendous political clout, which was essentially conservative and anti-democratic in nature. The nuclear arms race and the Cold War in general were a twofold liability to American society and assuredly Russian society as well. The citizens of both countries were held hostage to the fears and oppressive secrecy involved by both regimes and diverted requisite monies from domestic needs. Mutual paralysis might be an answer as to why the nuclear arms race and the Cold War lasted so long and ended only when the Soviet Union imploded as a result of the economic war that sustained the arms race. Even as the USSR expanded as an empire, its bloated military combined with increasing internal corruption and social paralysis were as fatal as syphilis, ignored for decades until insanity and death. An alternate answer might be that nuclear power provides humanity the opportunity to overwhelm the vestigial primacy of nature in favor of human supremacy over Earth, or so it is acclaimed by many who perceive nature as nemesis. Perhaps the most remarkable and puzzling aspect of the Cold War is that it ended without nuclear holocaust. Not even the collapse of the Soviet Union explains why. For sure, it came very close to committing the nuclear doctrine of mutual assured destruction, especially during the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, when it seemed an irreversible trajectory toward nuclear war between the U.S. and USSR, and perhaps other instances which have not been disclosed by either of the belligerents. even afterward, when previously discredited concepts of winnable limited nuclear wars gained popularity with civilian and military strategists during the Ronald Reagan administration in the 1980s. That particular insanity was bolstered by the fallacious claim that the United States could absorb 20 million casualties and can continue as a civilization. With the Cold War over and the Soviet Union relegated to history's dung heap along with the 20th century, it astonished and appalled. The USA, as the only remaining superpower, attempted to impose a millennial form of Pax Americana by reinvigorating a space satellite nuclear missile and laser system espoused by Reagan, the so-called Strategic Defense Initiative, popularly known, rather derisively, as Star Wars, from a sci-fi flick of the same name, which even at the time was considered extravagant, inept, unnecessary, and destabilizing. Yet President George W. Bush attempted to revitalize the discredited concept almost from the beginning of his unelected presidency in 2001. He was adamant about taking control of what he called the high frontier of space. Star Wars partisans insisted that it was a defense system, but SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, was actually devised as the ultimate offensive nuclear weapon, which would theoretically be capable of raining laser beams and nuclear missiles down upon any place on Earth, which still remains a theory as a result of many failures of implementation. The doublethink of Bush's nuclear policy, that any other nation's nuclear arms, including post-communist Russia, which kept most of its nuclear arsenal intact despite mutual winnowing by itself and the USA, are weapons of mass destruction, while the world-obliterating U.S. arsenal is a nuclear deterrent, has resonated throughout American foreign policy since the advent of the Cold War, and is hardly anything more than nuclear extortion. Be damned if you possess or develop nuclear weapons. Be damned if you don't. And now, Donald Trump, a prime exemplar of the most egregious type of humanity, has revealed his own adolescent comic book vision of space. He is impatient to reinvigorate near-space imperialism with his puffed-up version of Make America Great Again, resurrecting a new improved Star Wars, if it ever works, complete with a sixth force adaptation of Robert Heinlein's book and movie Starship Troopers. Pundits exclaim that Trump wants to be a real-life Darth Vader, but he might instead be a duplicate of a fictional terrestrial Navy ship's captain named Queeg from the book and novel The Kane Mutiny, who was called by his officers and crew Old Yellowstain for his cowardice in combat. And some may remember his psychotic incident with ice cream and missing strawberries. Coincidentally, he blamed the ship's black stewards. And what if, while Trump and his space patrol warriors stare down at Earth from military satellites and moon bases, an outer space species comes up from behind? Or a more probable scenario, one fine day, Earthlings somewhere on the planet will look up and see the spiky umbrella-like contrails of nuclear missiles entering the atmosphere from interspace, which in turn will inspire nukes launched from everywhere on Earth. And that was something I wrote, and I call it One Fine Day. And now, to elucidate the subject farther, an article for the Washington Post, actually back in April, by David Ignatius. Sitting at the controls of a Boeing spaceflight simulator, docking the company's planned Starliner craft with an imaginary space station, you begin to understand why the Pentagon is so focused on such advanced systems. Space is the new frontier of warfare. That was the theme of a space symposium in April at Colorado Springs that gathered thousands of military and corporate experts from around the globe. A variant of the Boeing simulator may someday be training the 21st century version of space drone pilots. The future battle may be in the heavens, but you can already see some sparring on the ground over who should control U.S. space warfighting capability, with the White House, Congress, and the military services debating how best to allocate hundreds of billions of dollars and scores of senior Pentagon command positions. But let's start with the threat, as described by U.S. military officials. Since the glory days of the first moonwalk in 1969, Americans have had a benign view of space as an area of uncontested U.S. dominance. When we thought about adversaries, they were from another planet. But animating nearly every military presentation was the message that China and Russia are now aggressively challenging U.S. primacy in space, potentially threatening satellites used for military communications, targeting, and battlefield management. I cannot think of a military mission that does not depend on space, Air Force Secretary Heather Wilson told the symposium, warning that Russia and China are developing capabilities to disable our satellites. General David L. Goldfein, the Air Force Chief of Staff, repeated like a mantra the phrase, "always the predator, never the prey," in describing how his service views its mission in space. An arms race in space, as dreadful as that sounds, is already underway. As the throngs at the Colorado Springs Symposium attest, it will be a bonanza for the Pentagon and its contractors. But there is broad agreement among analysts that the vulnerability of U.S. systems to attack is real. The threat is quite serious, says Robert O. Work, who was a deputy defense secretary in the Obama administration. He notes that Russia and China have demonstrated the ability to jam space communications, blind optical sensors with lasers, launch direct ascent at-east satellite weapons, and operate co-orbital anti-satellite weapons. Work says that when the Pentagon first described space threats to President Barack Obama in June 2013, officials warned him that the space arms race, quote, has already started. For the last 10 years, our competitive advantage in space has eroded steadily, argues John Hamry, a former Deputy Secretary of Defense who heads the Center for Strategic and International Studies. There is genuine alarm at the scale and momentum of the activities of our adversaries, he says. Though there is broad agreement that the United States needs to defend its space-based assets better, there is a political argument about who should have responsibility for that mission. The Air Force, not surprisingly, insists that it should take the lead. Goldfein told the symposium that the Air Force now is responsible for 90% of the military space activities and that it will bring dispute to future space operations, quote, the same passion and sense of ownership we apply to air, unquote. But some skeptics in Congress and the Trump administration argue that the United States needs a new space force to oversee the emerging domain of battle. The House proposed last year that this space component should be quasi-independent of the Air Force, the way the Marines operate alongside the Navy. The Senate disagreed. The Air Force lost credibility with Congress over the past decade, Hamry argues, because of concerns that it was slow to recognize the threat from adversaries and was, quote, unwilling to sacrifice other programs to fix the increasingly obvious shortcomings in the space program. But Work argues that because of the bureaucratic confusion and delay involved, creating the new force probably isn't sensible. We built exquisite glass houses in a world without stones, Heather Wilson told the Colorado Springs Symposium. But the old era of uncontested space, sadly, seems to be over. And that was David Ignatius. Will our next war be fought among the stars? And again, so around the same subject, something else that I wrote, and I wrote it quite a while back and rewrote it again and put it on this program late last year, but I thought this would be an opportune time to read it again. I call it The People's Bomb. Back in the last millennium, at the height of the Vietnam War, as well as the Cold War, a very unwarlike question became popular among the troubled who worried about war. Suppose they gave a war and nobody came. A fascinating thought, except there was always another side almost palpable about the question, more appealing to the darker ancestral, reptile part of ourselves. Suppose there was a war and everybody came. Now, with Donald Trump as America's Wolverine president, this other side of the question must be considered, and its possibilities are infinitely more fascinating. Because, theoretically, and according to the United States Justice Department, which in October 1979 attempted to squelch an article by Progressive Magazine about nuclear physics and how to build an H-bomb, citing it as a threat to national security, every man, woman, and child in the USA could become a nuclear power as a result of the Progressive publishing the article. The flap began earlier that year when a freelance writer named Hal Moreland toured the nuclear establishment and wrote what he learned for the Progressive. A journalistic leak that got as much attention as Three Mile Island sent the Justice Department scurrying to court with an order to suppress the article. The Progressive refused, quickly wrapping itself in the First Amendment. Lines were swiftly drawn across the country. The Justice Department's argument representing the U.S. government was that the national security, a religion you understand, was threatened if the article was published. The Progressive counter argued that the national security demanded the article be published immediately. The trick was defining national security. One side's view was that national security meant protecting the country from communists and the crazies who would start building H-bombs in their basements the minute the Progressive article was printed. The other side defined the national security as the Bill of Rights, and in particular the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of speech and of the press, and their less noisy corollary, the right to know. One citizen took the debate farther. He wrote a letter to a few newspapers providing the same information contained in Moreland's article, supporting Moreland's argument that everything in his story was public record and all he did was fit the pieces together. Computer programmer Charles Hansen, who wrote the multi-published letter, was angry that the government had dragged Progressive and Moreland into court when it had never prosecuted the scientists responsible for declassifying the documents Moreland researched. Immediately, the Justice Department sought to quash the letter, but a newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, where the Progressive is published, printed the letter quicker. The Justice Department dropped its case. The government lawyers said it no longer made sense continuing the case when everybody in the country had access to the information, but the possibility of criminal action was threatened. An act of incredible folly was the summation of a Progressive editor. He said the issues of nuclear weaponry should be open to the public instead of only a self-appointed elite. Everyone must believe in nuclear weapons, he said. They will not disappear simply because we wish them to. We must all understand how these weapons work, and we must be aware of the devastation they can cause. His words were like a fist hitting an open palm. We've got to destroy them before they destroy us. The only chance we've got is nuclear disarmament. The Progressive chose its risk carefully. Its decision to commission the article was based on one of the first principles of an open and democratic government. An informed citizenry makes reasonable decisions. The government violated that tenet. It had cloaked almost all information pertaining to nuclear physics in secrecy. And though so much got out, which proves the government is inept as it is shady, it attempted to keep the populace in ignorance and fear, an old trick of despots and despotism. Critics complained the article unnecessarily made the world a more dangerous place to live. The argument seemed based on the premise that the fewer who know or have control over such secrets, the safer the world is for the rest of us. The not-so-distant history of the Third Reich might be enough to reconsider the idea. One man, Adolf Hitler, was largely responsible for the nearly 60 million deaths of World War II. America's own secret wars in Laos and Cambodia, and the recent public revelation that American Special Forces troops and multi-million dollar drone bases are scattered all over Africa, revealed only because four of them were ambushed and killed in a Vietnam-style ambush in last October, are not quite the democratic actions our spouted ideals require. Innocent human beings have been destroyed in the name of America in these secret wars, ordered by the same officials who control the secrets of America's nuclear establishment. But the consent of the people was neither sought nor given. If there is any validity to the fear that an enemy could use the disclosed information against us, the nuclear power industry would be the most likely source. The industry exports its technology and material to whoever has the money. The danger is in the secrecy. Power and tyranny grow out of secrecy. Tyranny exists when a government makes its people afraid to know certain things. Time and again, since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the world has been at the brink of nuclear suicide. Each time, the rest of us wait in fear while a very few men, and fewer, if any, women, decide if they should destroy civilization, perhaps the entire species of Homo sapiens, which roughly translates humanity the wise. Possessing the secrets of the bomb gives power back to the people. So armed, a sovereign citizenry must be reckoned with. If we must all die in a nuclear holocaust, we should all damned well have something to say about it. And that was something I wrote, The People's Bomb. And it was originally published in the North Coast Times Eagle in October 1979. This is Michael McCusker.